Okay, sure. Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Trump has been in office less than 2 weeks, and already millions of Americans are in the streets protesting his noxious policies. Ultimately, we need thousands of people to run for office at every level, to bring new blood and progressive policies into government so we make the rules. Our guest today is one of the leading political consultants who knows how to run a campaign. Rick Ritter has worked on campaigns as campaign manager for Howard Dean and a host of other luminaries, including Al Gore and George McGovern. He is the author of a new book, Looking for Votes in All the Wrong Places, Tales and Rules from the Campaign Trail. Rick Ritter, welcome to All Together Now.
Well, thank you for having me, Eleanor. Much appreciated.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've been out in the trenches for decades helping progressives run and win campaigns, so we need your wit and wisdom now more than ever. Go ahead.
Well, it's been a tumultuous 2 week period, and every day we wake up for a new threat to progressive values.
Absolutely, and we need to get organized, and we need to run those campaigns and get new people in. But why do you think we're in this mess? Like, why do you think Trump won and Hillary lost, given how bad Trump is?
You know, you can't beat something with nothing, in the sense that there was a lack of message from Hillary Clinton. At few times did she really elucidate who she really was and what she was fighting for and who she was fighting for. There was always the assumption it was about women, it was about children to some extent, but fundamentally they confused experience with accomplishment. At no time did she really say, this is what I have done. And you compare that with Donald Trump, and you come away with a sense that, you know, he told, listen, I've hired hundreds of thousands of people, I've built this business empire, I've done all these great things. And it's far more defined in terms of their successes and a little bit better sense of what he would do. A friend of mine last month asked me, he said, okay, it's 2 months after the election. Tell me the three things Donald Trump will do as president. He was immediately able to knock off. He'll build a wall. He will close the borders to Muslims. And he will TPP us, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't name thereafter the three things that I thought that Hillary Clinton would do the first 3 months, 2 months uh-huh. after the election. So I think that's part of the reason that she lost.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom there.
You know, the other thing is communicating to voters that aren't on the coast. Well, I live in Colorado, and we rarely saw Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And there was sort of a symbolic assumption, well, we're going to go Democratic anyway, so we don't need to see her.
Kind of taking people for granted.
But it is also a statement of values about where you go, mm-hmm. not just a physical element of having the candidate there. It is a statement of what you think is important mm-hmm. and who you think is important.
Right, and I think there was some of that taking some voters in states for granted there.
Well, yeah, you got to at some point show up in Michigan.
Or Wisconsin or Colorado.
Or fortunately she was in Pennsylvania a great deal, but I don't know if she ever went back to her home roots near Scranton,
mm-hmm.
Her family roots. I think mm-hmm. that there was a sense always in the campaign that, you know, they had enough votes to win it regardless, and he needed a perfect storm, which is what he got. On the other hand, the last 2 weeks of the campaign, he was extremely disciplined, only went to 4 or 5 states, and knew that's the way he was going to win.
Mm-hmm. You know, interesting analysis. I think you got a lot of truth there. Anything else?
Well, the other thing I would say is, remember, that, you know, Hillary's campaign, in Colorado at least, was mostly 90% negative ads mm-hmm. about Donald Trump and his temperament. And very few ads on what she would do as president. We did for a client, we did some experimentation on voter registration in California. We did significant numbers of pieces of mail to register voters. And the one big surprise that came back from that experiment was among Latinos and Asians, the register to vote to stop Donald Trump mailers, the negative mailers, did not perform as well as the mailers that spoke about voting because it's your right, because there are military who are defending your right. In other words, it wasn't a vote. People weren't registering to vote to go after Donald Trump, which was the big assumption that the progressive community had. It was because they were registering to vote because they felt it was their national duty.
Very interesting. Yeah, and I think... you know, I agree with you. There was just a ton of negative ads. And I thought, really, why does Hillary have to spend those millions on all those negative ads? Just Trump is doing that himself every day. But, you know, tell us what you're going to do for us.
Right.
So, and we're
Which is
in
what he
this...
did.
Go ahead.
Which is what Donald Trump did.
Mm-hmm.
He fundamentally said the basics of political communication, which is, you know, what I'm going to do for whom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm going to make America great again. Okay, yeah, it's sloganistic. But voters, you know, basically had a sense of aspiration. I'm with her. Very self-focused.
Mm-hmm.
Forward together. Who's forward together? Strength together? Stronger together? Who's stronger together? What's the very limited aspirational element that tells you who and what she's fighting for?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so sorry you weren't running her campaign.
Well, I don't know if I would have made any difference. And one of the great things that I've learned after doing this for 30 years, that most campaigns, almost all campaigns, are a reflection in some way of the candidate.
Absolutely. I've thought that for years with the campaigns I've been involved in and watched. It's amazing. If you want to know what someone is like, look at their campaign.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, how's it run? What's their message? Why are they running? And the tactics even that they use.
Yeah. So. One of my favorite examples on that was if you look back in the day with Jesse Jackson, his campaign was so inspirational and, you know, lots of different people and across the rainbow and bring people together, very kind of grassrootsy. But then at the same time, it was like chaotic and lack of structure and disorganized, kind of scrambling at the last minute a lot. So, you know, I think that was one way to go. And then in that same race, you had Michael Dukakis running, who was very organized and systematic and running on time, but kind of had the soul of an accountant, kind of really didn't have much spirit behind it. And I just thought it was so reflective of the personalities and the candidates running.
That was, that is a wonderful analogy. In my book, Looking for Votes in All the Wrong Places, I talk about an experience with Al Gore in 1988 in New York City, where he was completely overwhelmed by New York City until he could find a place to simply drink and eat with voters and found his comfort level. But the campaign itself was a disaster because he wasn't comfortable in those surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he later became comfortable in those surroundings, but not as a first-term U.S. senator from Tennessee. It was still a little foreign to him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I'm glad you mentioned your book. I'm so excited you've finally written down all your amazing experiences. And also, you bring such a great sense of humor to the whole enterprise. And I think we absolutely need to have both, you know, strong strategic focus and also a sense of humor to help us through what we're going through right now. But your book here on looking for votes in all the wrong places, I think it could be a great guide because we do need thousands of people to run for office at every level. I'm thrilled with Bernie Sanders and our revolution that so many people are stepping forward to run. And I think your book could be a great help for people and a guide for people who are just now coming into politics and just now thinking of running for office. What would you say, what advice do you have for people who are thinking of running for office now?
The first thing I always ask them is, are you really ready to commit to a 12 to 14-hour day for minimum of 4 to 6 months? And that's the first thing, where everything from you forget to pay your electric bill, your lawn outside your home looks like it was the Sonora Desert, that your spouse is asked to go, you know, 100 miles in order to give a speech for you, or three people show up and you have to deal with that spouse that night, that these are
I hear the voice of experience in that story.
Yeah. Oh, you know, there's a whole chapter on spouses in my book, which really is, you know, why a number of my friends have no longer do candidate campaigns. And I asked one of them why he doesn't do candidate campaigns. He said, I only do ballot initiatives and referenda. And I said, well, why? He said, well, because ballot initiatives have no spouses. I think that most people aren't prepared for the taxation on their family resources, and I mean that in terms of everything from their personal financial situation to, you know, missing the kids' soccer game. These are very stressful moments for families, and I don't think most people recognize that, and it's hard to explain it to them. But fundamentally, if you're going to run for office, sit down and ask your question, why am I running? What do I want to do? Who do I want to do it for? And do I have the resources, intellectually, emotionally, to do it? Because there are going to be times where all sorts of things are said about you that are likely to be untrue, that are likely to be extreme exaggerations. And you will be saying things about other people that you probably you know, when you wake up in the morning, say, gee, I'd never say something like that. And the next thing you know, your media consultant or your mail consultant has presented you with a piece of mail attacking your opposition in terms that you find totally horrific, but realize that perhaps if I really want to win this election, that's what I'm going to have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And most people haven't come to grips with those type of things when they first run for office.
Yeah, I think that's wise words from the voice of experience there. And I'm thrilled that so many people want to come and run. And I'm a little concerned about, kind of the lack of awareness of what it really takes to do it. But there's nothing like experience. But are you advising any of these candidates, the ones who are with Our Revolution, do you have any link with them so you can offer some of your experience and guidance?
I haven't worked with any specific, individuals who've come forward, through the revolution or others. Our office is the center of a number of organizations that have been bolstered by the revolution. We're working with a group called Generation Latino, run by a wonderful woman by the name of Maria Hanley, whose husband was Bernie Sanders' political director. And they are, they are at the forefront of bringing new people, younger voters, into the political system. So, on a day-to-day basis, I haven't been involved in bringing candidates in, been spending a little bit more time on ballot initiatives and using organizational tools to, beat back some of these ideas, such as selling public lands. But doors always open for those people who have good ideas and the desire to make change.
Right, and we definitely need that now. And for our listeners to know, my guest next week is going to be the chair of the Bernie Sanders-founded Our Revolution. So we're going to be talking in some detail about what they're doing, what their plans are, and how they can get involved. So you definitely want to tune in next week for that. So your book here is a subtitle, The 22 Rules from the Campaign Trail. What are some of the rules people need to know or should know, even as a voter, or particularly if you are going to run, but all of us are voters. So what are some of those rules from the campaign trail?
Well, as I indicated, know why you're running for office.
Mm-hmm.
I talk a little bit about a candidate in another state, let's just put it that way, and I live in Colorado, who, upon asked why he was running, he basically said, oh, because I was asked by the leadership. Not exactly a great response.
Not inspiring.
So know why you're running. What it is, another guy I once worked with, I asked him, what are your qualifications? And he was running for state legislature, and he looked at me and he said, because everybody knows me in the district. I said, really? That's great. What do you do so that everybody knows you? He says, I'm an international cat judge. I judge cats over the world. And and I said, and that qualifies you to be what? And he said, well, I think I'll use my, impartial sense at the legislature. Well, he obviously had not met the dogs at the legislature, but more importantly, he was delusional that this was going to be something that was important to people.
Mm-hmm.
Really, what was important to people, that he was a part-time rancher. And
right.
That gave him a sense of, that he was part of this, or he was credible, that he was an honest individual and that was in touch with their values. But he
right.
wanted to run on the fact that he was an international cat judge. The other thing I always say is, remember, that you're going to say things that you may not absolutely 100% agree with. You know, frankly, unfortunately, personal integrity doesn't seem to be a qualification for office. Meaning,
well, we certainly see that all the way up to president.
Yeah, well, certainly up to the president. I mean, you know, there was a woman I worked with in the southern part of this country who, when asked what she didn't like about the state, said, and she was from the Northeast originally, I really don't like southern accents.
And she was running in a southern state?
Yeah, so she offended just about 97% of the voters in the state.
Yeah, and I saw that, by the way, with a candidate running in Massachusetts, which is the home of the Boston Red Sox, and we're all fanatical fans there, including me, by the way. I'm a governor of Red Sox Nation. But this candidate was running in Massachusetts statewide and actually said that she was a Yankees fan. I was like, game over. She's lost this election.
Yeah, done. Gone. Over. Right.
Right.
I mean, my friend Howard Dean grew up in New York and, you know, was governor of Vermont, which is part of Red Sox Nation. And he used to hide very quietly that he was a Yankees fan because that's where he'd grown up. And I used to joke with him that I said, whatever you do, don't possibly let anybody know that. But I think the point is this, that there are moments where people say things like that, and as a campaign consultant, you pick up the phone and you call them and you say, what the hell did you just do? You just offended the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
And this candidate goes, well, did you want me to lie? You know, that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, yes, please, lie.
Or don't address the topic.
Or answer the way that you want to answer.
Right.
You know, talk about something else, the sky, the moon, the sun. I don't care.
Or in that case, you could say how I love baseball and what a great game it is.
Yeah, right, exactly. Or, you know, I really never, you know, in that southern state, you said, I really don't understand why they have soccer games on Saturdays to conflict with college football. So all of this is to say that, you know, personal integrity, there are going to be times if you're a candidate that you're going to say things that are politically accessible that you may not agree with. You know, a lot of my stories are about international campaigns. And a lot of international campaigns are just like American campaigns, all screwed up. And, and you know, that's one of the things that so many candidates have a difficulty understanding, that they
right.
are going to have to give their life away to a campaign manager or an organization without knowing really who these people are, maybe having worked with them for about 3 hours, and all of a sudden you've got a scheduler who is scheduling your life, who you've never really met, who doesn't know that you have 2 children and 4 dogs, but knows that you have to be 2 hours away in 1 hour and 20 minutes, and you better get your ass out of the office. And say, who is this person who's running my life? But these are the type of things that's very difficult for many people, particularly those who have been entrepreneurs that have never really had to delegate large portions of their life schedule to somebody else and have them make decisions for you.
Right. Well, and I think you talk about all campaigns at some level are screwed up. And I remember my first campaign. I was campaign manager for a citywide candidate in Boston, which is huge, 640,000 residents. And I, when I run projects, I like them to be well thought out. You have your strategy, here's your mission, here's your goals, here's your steps, boom, boom, boom. And, you know, as neat and organized it can be. And a campaign, you can do that, but it's very chaotic. There's lots of variables. You always have more to do than you have time or resources to do the way you want. So I learned two things about that. One is that you need to be really flexible and let go of a standard of perfection and just, you know, do the best you can with the time and resources you've got. But the other thing is we won. And when you're in a campaign, you see all the missteps and mistakes. But I realized that in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed woman reigns queen, that you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be 10 votes better than the other guy.
Yes, I mean, I will argue that the best candidate, the best campaign I ever was involved in was one that lost.
Which one is that?
That was a woman by the name of Sandy Schofield in western Nebraska, a former rancher and a former state senator. And the average Democrat got 37% in that congressional district. And she got to 49.5.
Oh, my God, so close.
Yeah, so close. And ultimately, I think what did her in was her pro-choice position in a very Catholic district. You know, we had a real shot. And this was 1990, and we did most everything right. But, you know, everybody said, well, why didn't you win? Well, because, you know, remember, voting for a political party is one of the most, call it, repetitive actions that human beings take. 90% of the time, to 95% of the time, most people vote for the exact same party that they did the previous election. And so getting people to break that behavior is very, very difficult.
Yeah, although I think given how bad Trump and the Republicans are showing themselves to be, I think we might have a shot in the next election in 2018 to turn some of those so-called Republican districts Democrat, don't you?
I think there are some marginal districts that you're going to be able to move. Do I think that Democrats can take over the House of Representatives? No. I think it's just too difficult. The lines are too engraved politically for us to really take over the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, can we send a huge message? Can we get to that point where we're 5 or 10 seats down? Yeah. And with reapportionment coming up between 2020 and 2022, if we play our cards right and focus on state legislatures, yeah, we can take it back. But I
Fabulous.
Think that fundamentally, there's two things I keep telling people. The battle lines are not necessarily on the federal level right now. The battle lines will have to be on the state level in order to be able to do the setup to take back the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. Wonderful. Well, that's all the time we have. But how do people get in touch with you, Rick, if they want to run or know someone they want to run?
Well, two things. I'd like to say it's Rick Ritter, R-I-D-D-E-R, and our firm is RBI Strategies and Research. We have a website, and my email is right there. And two, you know, pick up the book, which is available on your favorite online bookseller, Looking for Votes in All the Wrong Places, as well as at Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C., and The Tattered Cover in Denver, Colorado.
Fantastic. Rick Ritter, thank you so much for being with us today and
well,
for all your work
Eleanor.
Helping
it's
elect
great
good
to
people.
Catch up with you.
All right. Good luck.
Good luck. Thank you.